So this class is my first time teaching one of these PSI classes. And so we'll see how this goes. This is quite different than I think like normal university classes from what I understand. Right, so Gon explained to me that most of you have not had previous cosmology classes in your undergrad, right? So that's true, okay? Right, so therefore I won't assume that you guys know basic undergrad cosmology, things like the Friedman-Robertson-Walker metric and so on. And so instead we will go through that, I guess, in this class. My understanding though is that all of you have had recently had general relativity, statistical physics, things like that. Some particle physics as well, or? Okay, less so. Okay, no, good to know. Okay, great. So then I'll assume that I don't need to review GR or StatFiz. Okay, what I'll try and do is to mostly follow this book, Modern Cosmology by Scott Jodelson. Here, let me write it down. The author is Jodelson. This version is an old version. There's a newer version that has two authors, Dolshin and also Fabian Schmidt. Anyway, yeah, so for those of you who plan to work in something like related to cosmology, I would strongly recommend getting this book. It's fantastic. It'll teach you everything you need to know to do like basically any calculation in modern cosmology. You know, this book has more or less become like the standard textbook in the field, at least for, you know, modern cosmology relevant for like large scale structure, the CMB, things like that. Another good resource, you know, if you don't want to read this entire giant book, is a shorter set of lecture notes online from Daniel Bauman. And so if you just Google Daniel Bauman lecture notes, you'll find it. Yeah, and if people are, you know, people are interested that, you know, I can also point you to some other resources besides these. Okay, good. So with all that preamble out of the way, then let's get started on the actual material in the class. So for this first class, mainly I just wanted just to do like a review of classical cosmology. Okay. Okay, so some of you presumably have seen this material before, but hopefully just talking about it again will be helpful, for you guys. So first thing we'll do just is to review just some very basic facts about the universe that we see around us. Okay, so let's just list some facts about the observed universe. Facts. So the first fact I'll mention is that on large scales, scales bigger than, say, like galaxies, gravity is the dominant force affecting how everything evolves. And as far as we know, gravity on these scales is described by Einstein's theory of general relativity. Okay, and so we'll assume that gravity is just GR for the purposes of this class. Okay, the second important fact is that there exists a frame in the observed universe for which what we see around us, the observed universe appears to be nearly homogeneous and isotropic, again on large scales. So homogeneity and isotropy of the observed universe. Okay, so what this means is that, for example, so if we just like count the number of photons that we see coming to us from the sky, that number of photons is essentially isotropic, so this number is the same in all directions at a level of like 1 part in 10 to the 5. Okay, so this background that I'm talking about, a photon, this is called the cosmic microwave background. And so we'll be talking more about that later on. Yeah.
Is the second statement frame dependent? And if so,
yes. It is a frame dependent statement, okay? So there exists a frame in which the microwave background looks isotropic to 1 part in 10 to the 5. If we boost ourselves relative to that frame, the photons will not seem isotropic, but instead we'll see a large dipole on the sky. Okay, so here on the Earth, we do actually see a significant dipole in the observed number counts of photons around us. And it's thought that this dipole is due to our motion relative to the mean rest frame of all of the photons in the universe. Okay.
So when we write the homogeneous and isotropic FLRW metric,
yes,
assuming that we are in that particular frame, but the whole concept...
It's convenient to work in that rest frame, the mean rest frame of the matter within our local horizon. That's right.
So we can work with some other metric as well and get same results?
Yeah, we're free just by coordinate invariance just to transform coordinates, work in some other frame, a boosted frame, different coordinates altogether. That's right. But of course, you know, due to the symmetries involved in having isotropy around us, it's most convenient to work in that frame, the rest frame of the contents, the mean rest frame of the contents of the universe. Yeah. Yeah, I should also stress that this statement is only true on large scales, okay? So obviously here in this room is not homogeneous, right? Similarly, you know, so here on the Earth, you know, the density here on the Earth is very different from the density out in space, okay? So the statement about, you know, homogeneity, isotropy, this is true on scales very large compared to the sizes of like things like galaxies, okay? So, okay, yeah, actually here, so yeah, how do I do this again? Okay, right. So for the cosmic microwave background of photons, okay, so the statement is that there exists a frame in which, you know, the temperature of the photon background is isotropic to like 1 part in 10 to the minus 5. Okay? But the statement isn't just true only just for the photons that we see. So similarly, if we just count objects around us, okay, so for example, if we count galaxies around us, then on very large scales, the number of galaxies over here and over here and over here are all about the same, okay, at a fixed moment in time. So, right, so crudely speaking, you know, like the number of galaxies, okay, is also uniform, okay, on very large scales. Okay, so uniform, let's say, to like, I don't know, like 10%. On scales of like hundreds of megaparsecs. And so for those of you who don't know about astronomy units, think of like a megaparsec as like millions of light years, okay? Okay, good. But anyway, yeah, okay, good. So, right, so what we see around us is that, yeah, both in, you know, the light coming from the very early universe of CMB, but also even like closer to us today, present time, the number of galaxies around us also roughly speaking, uniform spatially, okay? And then the third important point I'll mention is that the universe is expanding. Okay, so what does this statement mean? Okay, so what I mean by this is that if we measure the velocities of distant galaxies, what we find is that all these distant objects are all moving away from us. They're all receding away from us. So schematically, if we make a scatter plot, okay, of the velocities of objects that we see versus their distances away from us, okay, what we find is an almost linear trend. Okay, crudely speaking. Just to give you a sense of some of the numbers. Yeah, so this might be, let's say, hundreds of megaparsecs, and this might be like of order like 10 to the 4 kilometers a second. Okay, so right, okay, so yeah, so what we find is that the galaxies around us, they're all moving away from us, okay, with a velocity that gets larger and larger the further away each object is away from us. Okay, so this trend, you know, so this mean linear trend, this is called the Hubble law. Okay. And this linear relation holds out to distances of distances of like hundreds of megaparsecs. And the way that we understand this behavior, again, is from the expansion of the universe. Okay. So the basic idea is the following. Okay. You know, So the basic idea just is that the separations between objects like galaxies, over time, the separations just grow. They just scale up over time. Okay, so if we have, let's say, like, you know, a set of points, like a set of galaxies, okay, at some time t1, like this, okay, then at some later time t2, okay, the relative separations between these same objects at some later time will just be a scaled up version of this previous separation. Okay, you know, so at some later time it might look more like this. Okay, so more precisely, the separation vector, call it d, okay, between any pair of objects or galaxies, let's say, okay, you know, some time t2, is equal to the same separation vector at some earlier time multiplied by a ratio of what's called the scale factor. Okay, so this function a of t, the scale factor, it just tells us how all distance vectors, they just scale up as the universe expands over time. Okay? Now it's convenient to scale out this overall scaling behavior by defining new coordinates instead of these proper physical coordinates. Okay? And so instead we'll define what are called co-moving coordinates, in which the physical or the proper displacement vectors, okay, as a function of time t, we can write as some scale factor, again, a of t, multiplied by a co-moving vector. Okay? And so all the time dependence is then captured in this one function applying for all of space, for all objects. Okay? And instead, the unscaled part is all captured in this co-moving number. Okay? Good. So then from this expression, it's then trivial to see where this Hubble relation comes from. Okay, so just to go through it really, really straightforwardly. Here, I'll make more room. Okay, so if we take, you know, some set of points, okay, d of t, and then, you know, and then if we evaluate the time derivative of this to get the velocity, the relative velocity, v of t, which I'll write as d by dt of this separation vector. Okay? So now if we plug in that this physical distance is just a of t times some co-moving distance. So this is obviously then just dA dt times the co-moving vector. Okay, which I can write as 1 over a dA dt times the physical, the proper vector. Okay, and then we'll define this quantity to be what's known as the Hubble constant h. Okay, so this h of t is defined to be a dot over a. And this h is just the slope of this line relating velocity and distance, as you can see. Okay, good. So you can see that this expanding universe, okay, you know, so this predicts that the relative velocity between these freely falling points is just proportional to the separation, the current separation between those points. So any questions about that? Pretty standard stuff, right? Okay. Let me just mention one subtlety here, okay? So this expression says that for all distances, the velocity between the points is just linearly proportional to the distance, right? But actually, if we extend this plot, okay? So if we extend this out to much, much larger distances, okay? So here, let me just draw that. Okay, you know, what we'll find is that this trend deviates from just straight line behavior. I think in this space, I think it'll deviate in this sense. Okay, you know, so for very large distances, we start seeing deviations away from that straight line behavior, which might then seem confusing given this expression. So do you guys have any ideas, you know, for why in practice on very large scales we see deviations away from this very simple linear prediction? Good idea, but no. So even, I mean, right, like, you know, so even for universes without dark energy, this is still true, that you'll see deviation from straight line.
inflation? Big Bang?
No. Okay. So again, so all this is still for times that are long after, let's say, inflation, long after the Big Bang. But you also had your hand up.
Could you have more error farther away in how you measure the velocity and the distance?
Oh, yeah, good idea. I mean, okay, yeah. It is true that the error bars do get worse, but even accounting for that, I'm saying, so we see a systematic deviation away just from this linear trend at small distances. Okay, good. So keep the ideas coming. Any more thoughts? Yeah?
Sitter curvature?
Sitter curvature.
Is it because we assumed everything was flat here?
Oh, well, so I haven't said anything about curvature yet. Yeah, so these statements will also hold true even for curved universes, as we'll see. I have been kind of sneaky here.
Isn't the fact that the Hubble rate changes with time and it's not constant?
Good, but why does, yeah, that's right. Okay, good. But why does that matter?
It matters because of the matter component of the universe that is dominant at each.
Well, okay, so, yeah, so, okay, good. So this relation between velocity and distance, these are all evaluated at some time.
Yes.
Okay. However, though, the speed of light is finite, right? So at some enormous distance away from us, we're not seeing these galaxies at the same time as these galaxies. Instead, we're seeing these at some earlier time, right? Okay, right. And so at earlier times, this Hubble rate doesn't have to be the same as it is today, for reasons that we'll get into, hopefully today, maybe tomorrow. So the reason for this deviation is, as you say, that things evolve over time. And the fact that we have a finite speed of light means that we're seeing different galaxies at different times. So it's just a subtle point, okay? The scale on which we'll start to see that deviation, roughly speaking, something like, distances corresponding to times of order the Hubble time, the age of the universe, okay? So for look back times of order like 1% of the Hubble time, then we'll see like 1% deviations from this linear behavior, and so on and so on. Okay, anyway, yeah. So it's a small subtlety. Another subtlety that we'll see later on is that for expanding universes, the very concept of what is a distance also becomes a bit ill-defined. Okay, but anyway, but before that, let me just mention some other things. Okay, the next thing I wanted to mention was something called redshifts, okay? And the basic idea behind redshifts just is that the expansion of the universe acts to slow down any motion relative to this mean Hubble expansion, okay? And it's easy to see why that happens, all right? So let's consider two points, point A and point B, all right? And suppose that these two points are separated by some proper distance, dx, okay? And also suppose that these two points, A and B, okay, suppose that they're also both co-moving with the Hubble expansion, okay? So therefore, because of their relative separation, dx, they'll have a relative velocity between them, okay, which I'll write as dv is h dx. Okay, which is, again, definition of h is a dot over a dx, okay? Where again, a is the scale factor. Okay, now, suppose that point A sends, sends some particle towards point B, okay? The particle could be like a photon, it could be some other like, non-relativistic particle, okay? Some particle, all right? So suppose that the particle it sends has some momentum P, as seen by A, and some energy E, okay? Again, as seen by A. Then the velocity that A sees the particle leaving it will be, what'll it be? Do you guys know? For momentum P, energy E, what's the velocity?
Is this a massive particle?
Sorry?
Is this a massive particle?
Doesn't matter.
Well, if it's proportional to the wavelength, then the momentum is like lambda h bar?
Well, E is equal to P dot V, right? So for magnitude P, V is P over E.
Wait, wouldn't that be E over P?
Sorry?
Yeah, you said E equals P times V.
Oh, did I? Oh, this is... Okay, I must have messed up something. I'm pretty sure this is true, right?
Non-relativistic particle of relativistic.
Okay, well, what I have in my notes again is that well, this is embarrassing. So now I've forgotten my most basic special relativity. Okay, should we just go through one example maybe, just to make sure? Okay, so let's say the velocity is V, the energy is m squared gamma mv is the momentum, and the energy is p squared plus m squared. These are all true statements, right? good. And that's also true, right?
M squared.
So then V is P over E, right? Okay. I'm not sure why I got confused about that before. Okay, yeah, okay, okay, good. But I was ultimately right. Okay, good. So V as seen by A is P over E. It's okay. When you're my age, you forget everything that you learned like 30 years ago. I forgot where I put the chalk. Okay, good. Good, so that's the velocity as seen by the guy who emitted it, which is A. Okay, so how much time then will it take for the particle to go from A to B, given this velocity? Okay, you know, assuming that, you know, this relative separation is small, okay, the time it'll take will just be dt is dx over V, right? Okay, which is okay, so far so good. Now, because of this relative velocity, okay, point B who receives the particle, okay, you know, point B will see, you know, that particle as being Doppler shifted, right? Okay. So therefore, point observer B will see the particle reaching it with a slightly smaller momentum. Okay, so how much smaller? Let's see, this is the middle or the back. Okay, so how much smaller? Well, the Doppler shift, dp, is just minus dv. And then plugging in our expression for the difference in velocity, this is minus e h dx. Okay, good. So far so good for everyone. Okay, good. So this is the difference. This is the difference in momentum seen by B versus A, and this is the amount of time it took to go from A to B. Okay, so then dividing these two, dividing this by this, we get dp dt. Okay, you know, which is just P dot. Okay. So dividing this by this, dx's cancel. Okay. The e's cancel. And what are we left with? We're left with minus h times p. So would everyone follow that? Okay. And again, h is just a dot over a. So this is minus a dot over a times p. Okay. So p dot is just, yeah, minus a dot over a times p, which I can then rewrite as dp over p is equal to minus dA over A. Or in other words, the momentum scales like 1 over A. Okay? So what this says is that if we just cumulatively add up all of the little Doppler shifts caused by these, caused by these relative velocities, okay, this causes the apparent, the observed momentum to appear to decay over time, as long as these momenta are relative to the mean co-moving Hubble expansion. Okay? So therefore, what we expect is that all motions relative to the mean expanding universe should decay over time. Okay, so does that make sense? So good. Let me then come back to this plot that I drew up here. Right, so it says plot was showing the mean trend, but I also drew scatter, because observationally there was like a lot of scatter. And that scatter isn't just measurement noise, okay? So the fact that we see scatter relative to the mean Hubble flow should be surprising given this fact that I just said, right? We just said that all motions relative to the Hubble flow should decay over time, okay? So we see motion relative to the Hubble flow today, many, many billions of years after the Big Bang. So that statement should seem puzzling to you, right? We just said that all these motions should decay over time. They should decay like 1 over the scale factor. And we believe that the scale factor has grown enormously across the age of the universe. So therefore, how can there be anything left over? How can there be any scatter about that mean relation? What do you guys think? Do you have any ideas for how it's possible to have anything residual? Yeah?
You can have motion due to gravitational force.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah, very good. Okay, good. So, right. So the fact that we see something left over today, despite this general decay, it means that something has to be sourcing these motions, okay? There has to be some sort of acceleration driving these deviations away from the mean Hubble relation. And as you said, the only thing that can operate on these scales is gravity, okay? So what's happening is that the universe is actually not exactly homogeneous and isotropic. There are local fluctuations, local density fluctuations. These local density fluctuations then source local gravitational fluctuations, okay? And so all this scatter today is driven by gravitational fluctuations, okay, coming from the departures from an exactly homogeneous isotropic universe. Yeah, very good. Okay, good. So that was one consequence, okay, right. So these momenta should all decay over time, unless they're being actively sourced. The other consequence of this is redshift, okay. So let me just write that down. Let's see. Oh, actually, I can go to this board, can't I? Let me leave this up. Okay, so cosmological redshifts. Okay, so what we just derived, that's true for any particle, including photons, including light that we see from distant objects, right? Okay, So therefore, if we have some distant source, like some distant galaxy, okay, a distant source of light, okay, emitting photons at us, the momentum of the photon that we observed will be different, will be different than the emitted momentum, okay? It'll be the emitted momentum multiplied by this ratio of scale factors between emission and observation. Okay, so it'll be the emitted multiplied by a emits over A observed. Okay? The observed momentum will equal the emitted momentum multiplied by the ratio of scale factors from the time of emission compared to the time today when we observe that, that photon. Okay? And the way that people heuristically think about it just is that the wavelengths of the photons have expanded with the mean expansion of the universe. Okay, so to make that point more precise, okay, so for photons, P is h nu, right, h bar omega h nu, right? Okay, which is hc over lambda, and c is equal to 1. Okay, so therefore, the observed wavelength of some photon that we see is equal to the emitted wavelength, okay, multiplied by, again, this ratio of scale factors, A observed, okay, actually, here, I'll write this as A of T observed compared to A of T emit. Okay, now by convention, we write this. Okay, good. So by convention, we define A today to be 1. Okay, just to make things easier. So therefore, lambda observed is, yeah, you know, lambda emitted over A. And then the quantity of the redshift, just by convention, is defined to be this. So lambda emit times 1 plus redshift. Okay? So the redshift is defined to be 1, the redshift is defined such that A is equal to 1 over 1 plus Z. Okay? So why am I stressing about redshifts? The reason is that, you know, redshifts and scale factors, they are directly observable astronomically, okay? The way that we can observe them is that we see some distant source of light, like a star or some distant galaxy. We can measure the spectrum of light emitted from that object. A spectrum in general will have spectral features like absorption lines, emission lines. We know from laboratory atomic physics here on the Earth the locations in frequency or wavelength where those lines should be. We compare those line locations observationally to, to the Earth laboratory locations. That comparison then tells us the redshift or the scale factor of the galaxy emitting that light to us. Okay, so therefore this quantity is a direct observable for our galaxies, and because we can directly observe it, you know, it's therefore useful to us as a time coordinate, as a distance coordinate. Okay, as we'll see later on. Okay, so anyway, so a high redshift galaxy is therefore a galaxy back in the very early, very distant universe from us. Okay, so any questions about redshifts? Okay, no, if not, then let's then go on to the next important thing, which is the Friedman-Robertson-Walker space-time, or also called the Friedman-Lemaitre. Okay, anyway, I'll just write it as FRW, okay? So the FRW space-time. Okay? So this space-time is just a model to describe a universe like what I said, that is a universe that is on large scales homogeneous and isotropic, expanding, and for which gravity is described by GR. Okay? So this is a four-dimensional space-time, obviously. And so the four coordinates that we'll use will be the normal coordinates. Okay? I'll just pick t in either x, y, z, or r theta phi. It doesn't really matter, it's up to you. Now to define the space-time, we have to define the metric on this coordinate system. So for simplicity, I will choose the metric to be co-moving with the Hubble expansion, okay? So it is, I will pick co-moving coordinates, okay? So what that means is that we will scale out the overall expansion of the universe in our spatial coordinates. Okay? So to do that, okay, all we have to do is the following. We can write the line element, ds squared, you know, the usual way, minus dt squared, and okay, Okay, so for, you know, for flat space time, we would just write, you know, for Minkowski, you know, dx squared minus dt squared. And then to account for this overall rescaling, I'll just pull out a factor of this scale factor. Okay? So a of t squared multiplied then by the spatial length, which we can write as, I don't know, dx squared. Okay? Where again, this spatial part, dx squared, is just given by the spatial part of the metric, dxi, dxj. Okay, good. All right. Since I am going slower than I wanted, maybe I'll skip the derivation of the form of the spatial metric and just give you the answer. Okay. So most generally, we can write the spatial part of the metric for a homogeneous isotropic space allowing for non-zero curvature in the following simple way. Okay, so we can write this dx squared as dr squared plus some function I'll specify, r squared, d omega squared. Okay, so here r is a radial coordinate, and this d of r is a function that I'll specify called the angular diameter distance. It has the following form. And for a positively curved space of radius of curvature, call it capital R. It's given by R sine. Okay, so this is for positive curvature. And for a negatively curved space, it is a very similar form. So it's given by, again, radius of curvature and then sinh of R over R. Okay, right, you know, so, you know, one way to understand this just is to think about the metric on like a two sphere, right? You know, its form is very similar. Instead of this d omega, you have like d phi squared. Okay.
By curvature, you mean a non-trivial cosmological constant, or could be in?
So I haven't said anything about cosmological constant yet, okay? I'm just saying that this space is homogeneous and isotropic and can have a non-zero spatial curvature. Okay, so again, spatial curvature again just means, you know, difference between like a flat sheet versus like the surface of a sphere, surface of a saddle. That's all I mean. Okay, but the generalization of that now to three spatial dimensions instead of two, you know, two spatial dimensions. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay, good. Yeah.
How did we define capital R?
I didn't define it. Yeah, so capital R, just think of it as the curvature scale, the curvature radius of this universe, okay? So for your space, there is a mean curvature. It has to be, you know, exactly just the mean curvature because we're assuming a uniform universe, right? You know, homogeneous isotropics. So therefore, the curvature here has to be the curvature here, okay? So curvature has units of 1 over a length squared. So I'm just defining that length scale, the curvature length scale, as this R. Okay, good. So for a spatially flat universe, the curvature scale would be infinite, i.e. zero curvature. Okay, good. And you can see that taking the R goes to infinity limits of either of these just gives us back this, right? I'm seeing some confused looks about that. Do you guys not believe that? What's that? Okay, good. I lost where I was. Okay, good. We can also write this more compactly if you want in the following compact way, which I don't like, but people often write this in, you know, in the literature. So we can also write this as the same R and then a number k, the minus 1/2. Sine of k to the 1/2 r over r, where this k is plus one for positive curvature, zero for flat, negative one for negative curvature. Yeah, is it? Yeah, okay, yeah, that makes sense to everyone? Okay, good. Okay, good. Since we're free to pick any coordinates we want, you'll often see in the cosmology literature a different way of writing the same metric, okay? So sometimes you'll see people use not this little r as the radial coordinate, but instead this d as the radial coordinate, okay? And it's easy to, you know, to express the metric in that coordinate instead of this little r, okay? You know, just by using this expression for capital D, okay? So for example, let's take the positive curvature case where we have d is r sine of little r over big R. Okay, so in the positive curvature case, okay, then we have that r is equal to r inverse sine of d over r, in which case, the differential d little r is d over square root of 1 minus d squared over r squared. Okay? So then if we now replace this dr squared by dd squared, okay, you can see then the metric becomes and then the same a squared, and okay, so this is the exact same as the, you know, as the metric that we wrote here. Okay, you know, all I've done just is to replace little r with capital D as my choice of radial coordinate. Okay, and so you'll see both of these forms in different books and different papers. Okay, so okay, anyway, yeah, so good. So right, so then this is the FRW metric. This is the most general expression for a metric for a spacetime that is homogeneous, isotropic, and expanding. Okay, right, and again, this A again is the scale factor of the universe. And then we can pick either D or R as our choice of the radial coordinate. Okay, so again, so you've all had GR, I believe. So therefore, I'm assuming that you all know how to work with these sort of metrics. But just to make sure that we're all on the same page, it might be useful just to go through some simple, easy examples of using this, you know, these metrics. Okay? So good. Okay, so first easy example. Okay, here, let me come back. Okay, so suppose we have two points. Okay, point one, point two. Okay, suppose that this point is at some time t, r equals zero, theta, phi, and this point is at time t, some non-zero r, theta, phi, okay? Then what's the distance, the proper distance between these two points? Any ideas? Okay, good. So should we do that? Okay, right, so, right, okay, good. But why is it only GRR? Like, you know, why not GTT? Why not?
They don't have the same time.
Yeah, exactly. Right, exactly. DT is zero, D theta is zero, D phi is zero. Okay? Right? We have DS squared is, okay, and GRR is what? It's just A squared. Right? Okay, so we can square root everything, integrate everything, okay? We're evaluating A, you know, I mean, right, like, you know, we're evaluating all this at a fixed time, so therefore we can pull A out of the integral. Okay, so this is just R. Okay, and so the proper distance is just scale factor times r, which makes sense because r is a co-moving coordinate, right? Good. Okay, second easy example. Very similar. Suppose we have two different points, but now at using capital D equals 0 and some non-zero capital D instead of little r. Okay, so then similarly, what's the proper distance between those points? It's the exact same reasoning as before. Okay, but now instead of grr, we have the metric in, so now the hidden d coordinates. Okay, but gdd, as we wrote down before, was here. So ds squared is a squared of t, d squared over 1 minus right? Okay, and then similarly, then we can just, again, square root everything, and then integrate, okay? And then, right, and then this integral, you know, not surprisingly, works out to like an arc sine or an arc sinh, depending on the sine of this k. Okay, good. Third easy example before, yeah, just to make sure that everyone's on the same page. Okay, suppose you have two points at the same t, r, and phi, but different thetas. Okay? So then what's the proper distance between those? Okay, so just to draw it out, the same r, but different theta. So theta equals 0 and some non-zero theta. What's the distance between these points? We just take the theta component. Okay, so this d omega squared is a usual, is d theta squared plus sine squared theta d phi squared. You've all seen that before, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so integral of, again, a we pull out, d of r we pull out, integral d theta, okay? So therefore, it's just a times is d times delta theta, okay? So this d is what's called the angular diameter distance. It tells us how to translate angular diameters into relative distances, okay? The way that I've written it here, this capital D is a co-moving angular diameter distance, and a times capital D is the proper or the physical angular diameter distance, okay? As you often see in the literature, this thing written as dA, A times this big D that I wrote, okay? Good, all very easy, right? Sort of obvious, okay. Last easy example. Suppose that we have some photon emitted at some time t emit, and then suppose that it's observed at some later time delta t, so t plus delta t. Okay, what is the co-moving distance the photon has traveled in that time delta t? So that's a little bit more. A little bit less trivial than these. So any thoughts about how to do that?
Physical distance traveled?
I asked for the co-moving distance, which is related, of course, to the physical distance, yeah. Okay, so to do this, the key thing you'll have to know is that photons move at?
Null
geodesics, exactly. Good, yeah, good. The speed of light, exactly, that's right. Okay. So they have ds squared for null geodesic is 0, okay, which is minus dt squared plus a squared. Okay, and for simplicity, I will choose my coordinate such that this is moving along the radial direction purely. Okay. Okay, so a squared of t dr squared, which means that the r that it travels, okay, so again, r is the co-moving distance. The r that it travels is the integral over dr, is therefore the integral dt over a of t. Okay, that makes sense. Remember this expression. This will be useful for later on when we discuss horizons in an expanding universe. Okay, you know, so later on we'll discuss the maximum distance that your past light cone can cover, or your future light cone can cover. Okay, but in the final few minutes, let me just jump to another important thing. Okay, so as you said, these photons follow null geodesics. So let's get some more practice by working out geodesics in these FRW spacetimes. Okay, so what I mean by that is let's compute how the momentum of some particle behaves over time in one of these FRW spacetimes if the particle follows a geodesic and is not being accelerated. Okay. So the way that I'll write it not being accelerated is that its momentum p mu, its time derivative is zero, right? Where now here the dot means the covariant time derivative, right? Okay, so since this p is not a scalar, but a four vector, okay, its covariant time derivative is not the same as just the partial derivative with respect to time, right? So do you guys remember how the covariant derivative is different than the partial derivative? Mm-hmm. Yeah, so here, let's just write it out. So dp mu dt is equal to partial p mu, and then plus a correction, right? This correction depends on the Christoffel symbols. So I'll write as mu, T, I don't know, alpha, P alpha. Familiar? Good. Okay. Now, as you may recall from your GR class, these Christoffel symbols are related to the metric. Okay. And I'll write it the following way. So gamma mu alpha beta is 1/2 g mu nu, and then a whole bunch of terms. So I'll write as d beta g nu alpha plus d alpha nu beta minus d nu okay. Good. So now we can work out all these Christoffel symbols, knowing the form of our metric. Okay. So so let's just write down all the metric coefficients. Okay. So we have GTT minus one, right? GRR is a squared. G theta is a squared d squared of r. G phi phi is a squared d squared of r sine squared theta, right? Okay, so in the homework or in the tutorial, so I might have you guys work out these Christoffel symbols given this form of the metric. It's very straightforward. But for our purposes right now, I won't need all of them, okay? I'll just need some of them just to work out this expression, for the geodesics. Okay, so to make my life a little bit easier, I'll assume that the momentum is pointing in the r direction, okay? That is p theta and p phi, I'll assume are zero, okay? And then I'll work out how does dp r dt behave, okay? So therefore, all I'll need now is Okay, so this is dp r dt plus, I mean, here, I'll just replace all these mu's by r's. Okay. Okay, so now the only step now, you know, is to evaluate these Christoffel symbols for this r, this t, for different alphas. Okay? And that's pretty easy. So here. Let's just set mu equal to r, alpha or beta equal to t. We're almost out of time. So since we're almost out of time, maybe I can leave this to you as an exercise. It's very straightforward to evaluate. What you should find at the end, once you evaluate all these Christoffel symbols, what you should find at the end is that all this boils down to that dpr dt plus a dot over a, Kronecker delta r alpha p alpha is equal to 0. And so now I can do the summation over alphas. Okay, and of course this is the exact same thing that we derived before using physical arguments, okay? Okay, you know, so you can see that for geodesics and in an FRW universe, we can recover the behavior that we had before, i.e., momenta will all redshift. Okay. Okay, I think we are out of time. Okay, so then the next thing that I wanted to do then was to then evaluate the Einstein field equations for this metric. I'm a bit slow today, sorry. Next time we'll go faster. So next time then we'll start off on evaluating the Einstein field equations for this metric. Okay, all right, so we'll stop here. Oh yeah.
When you replaced the R coordinate with the capital D, There was like a coordinate singularity in the metric?
There's a coordinate singularity in the metric. Okay, let me find that board again.
Possible one. I was wondering if it was like a cosmological horizon or if it has any physical meaning.
Oh, yeah. Very good. Yeah, that's right. That's exactly right. So for distances of order, the curvature scale. Good. So the analog is the following. So think about like the two sphere. So suppose that you're an observer living at like the north pole of the two sphere, and you want to compute the distance between two points at different longitudes. Okay. So the analog of capital D is the latitude, right? Okay, you know, the further you are away, that's the further latitude, okay? So when the latitude approaches the curvature scale, i.e. approaches, you say, like the equator or the south pole, okay, then you'll start seeing that with the same angular separation, the physical separation gets smaller and smaller, okay? The exact same thing is happening, here. Does that make sense?
So as you look at larger d, the distances become?
Yeah, smaller and smaller, depending on the sign of that k. Smaller or larger, yeah.
To the point where they reach zero, or?
That's right. It's just like, again, looking at, looking at points near the south pole from the north pole, right? Okay, so these two points are actually very close to each other. But because of our coordinates, they have very different coordinates. Even though they, so this point versus this point, right? These two points seem to have pi different longitude, but they're very close to each other because of where they are in the space. And the same thing is happening, here. Yeah.
And the physical intuition is that if we look back at our expanding universe, things are very close?
Oh, no. So even if the universe were not expanding, okay, so even if this A were constant, this effect would still happen. Yeah, okay, right, you know, so for these sort of compact spaces, on top of that, there's the extra effect that the universe is expanding, and as you look further and further away, you're seeing things at some earlier part of the universe, okay? But that's on top of this, you know, this coordinate effect that you were wondering about. Yeah, yeah. But good question. Yeah. Okay. Any more questions before we break?
In this analog that you mentioned, distance is dr, right? And the capital D plays the role.
Yeah. In this example, think of this capital D as being like the latitude is the word, right? This coordinate, as opposed to this coordinate, right? Yeah, it's hard to think about three spheres in our, in our three-dimensional space, right? You know, but the analog of D for our three sphere, the space of positive curvature, the analog would be this coordinate, like the latitude coordinate. Yeah. You know, it might be useful for you guys actually to derive the form of this spatial metric just by considering the geometry of some three-sphere. You know, I mean, the surface of a three-sphere. Yeah. Well, yeah, a three-sphere. the exact same reasoning that you go through to work out distances on the surface of this two-sphere, the exact same reasoning also then applies on the three-sphere. And it's actually very easy to derive this form of the metric. So it might be worth just going through that for yourselves, just to see where this comes from. I've been skipping all that because again we have 13 hours to do all the cosmology. Any more questions?
Hi.
Yeah.
Like there when we discussed the momentum decays with time because it's one over a, and we said that we don't observe that because of gravity. So,
Say it again.
You said that we don't observe that, like we observe.
These velocities relative to the mean Hubble expansion. That's right. Yeah.
So.
Yeah. We. Yeah. You
we
know.
This,
that's right.
Assuming that we have expansion, but without taking
expansion in a mean universe. Expansion in a homogeneous universe, an exactly homogeneous universe. That's right. Okay. Good. So for a exactly uniform universe, any motion relative to the co-moving expansion must decay. Okay.
But
because we don't have an exactly uniform homogeneous universe, there are local density fluctuations which give local gravitational fluctuations, producing motion relative to the expected motion for a exactly homogeneous isotropic universe. Yeah, and those gravitational forces then provide a source for these relative velocities, keeping them non-zero. Yeah, we're actually even making them grow over time. Yeah, so in cosmology, like the fun stuff is all the perturbations, and it'd be nice to actually get to perturbations if possible, but we'll see.